from deep inside your radio.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing.
Thank you, Joe Biden, and I know you don't. As a matter of fact, the Washington Post kind of proved it in a story they ran last week with a major explanatory follow-up yesterday by Barton Gellman, who wrote still the best book about Dick Cheney, if you're interested, called Angler. The first chapter alone, ladies and gentlemen, worth the price. Anyway, in that Washington Post piece, Gellman and his colleagues reported that contrary to what the NSA has been saying, yes, the NSA does have content, not just metadata, and of Americans, not just foreigners, and people who aren't targets. 9-to-1 ratio of people who aren't targets of any intelligence probe versus people who are. Baby pictures. Pictures of people in sexy lingerie, probably women, collected by the NSA, stored, you know, probably in that big place in Utah. Bluffdale, I'll say. So, yeah, Joe, I know you don't have to hear my phone conversations anymore. You can read my email over at Bluffdale. Bluffdale, you bet. Not secret, but kind of hiding in the weeds, but thanks to the San Diego desk, known to your host, NPR advertising for a new ombudsman wouldn't be noteworthy, except that several times in the advert, and it's a very lengthy one with all sorts of explanations and conditions and specifications, they make it clear that it is not the ombudsman's job to pass judgments on NPR's journalism. So you will have the title of ombudsman if you're chosen for this job, but you'll be wearing the costume of a cheerleader. Now, ladies and gentlemen, streets, or as they're more commonly referred to these days, streets. Man, this is catching on. Streets. Destruction. I'm hearing it everywhere. And the latest in the death of the sound of the letter S, both in Australia and Britain. I don't think this is happening so much in the United States, because we're number one, is not even before consonants now, but before a vowel, the vowel U. Assume, presume, holy mackerel. Goodbye, letter S. Goodbye, the sound of the letter S. Anyway, streets, ladies and gentlemen. We're all going to sound like John McCain when we grow up. Last week, London played host, among other British cities, to the Tour de France. And France, in reciprocity, learned to cook badly for a week. The Tour de France, now, as an event that takes over city streets, it pales before, let's say, a marathon or a Formula One race, which is now being proposed for London. But, you know, because basically they stand there for hours, and then the bicyclists go by, and then that's it. And they've seen the crowd, the huge crowds that it draws. Saw, you know, maybe 4/100ths of a race. But they got to buy T-shirts that said they were here. So that was important. But I bring all this up because, you know, Formula One race being proposed for London. I wonder if Formula One is going to pay, like, mega bucks for the right to use those streets that citizens paid to build and maintain. Bernie Eggleston, who runs Formula One, is a rich guy. Or are they going to be like the NFL when they award a Super Bowl to your town or mine and come in with, well, we want this and we want this and you'll give us this. But the NFL, of course, is a nonprofit organization, so why shouldn't they? And in Los Angeles, more and more people who live on streets in the city but don't really want the traffic of the nearby avenues and boulevards just petition the city council and get their own little street cordoned off. Now, I don't live in the city of Los Angeles, haven't for years. So anybody who does, tell me if your tax bill shows that they've taken those streets off your tax bill. You don't have to pay for maintaining those anymore because you can't drive on them. I thought parks would be a good place for, you know, marathons and Formula One. And no, in answer to the usual suspects, no, I was not inconvenienced one whit by the Tour de France being in London last week. All right. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Newly released documents about a local priest in the Twin Cities disclosed that the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis placed Joseph Wajda in a top position on the marriage tribunal after it moved him among eight parishes. Those moves came after Wajda was accused a month into his priesthood in 1973 of propositioning a boy for sex and continued to be the subject of such allegations. He was accused of making a teenage boy walk around his office naked and pleasure himself, paying minors for sex, buying expensive presents for teens, and taking boys to saunas, according to formerly secret documents released by the Archdiocese in a court case and made public this week by an attorney, a plaintiff in the case of Doe 1, a lawsuit filed against another former priest. 67 and living in Minneapolis, Wajda was removed from the ministry in 2003. He has repeatedly denied molesting children, but the Archdiocese has requested that the Holy See remove him from the clerical state. The Vicar General says, "We offer our assurances that today we handle things differently regarding priests who've been accused of sexually abusing children." The phone number could not be located for Wajda, so don't try calling him. And the new Iraq, we're busted our buttons over this, ladies and gentlemen. We did a bang-up job, literally. Quote, when the British set up this country in the 1920s, they didn't do a good job. That's Colonel Galeb Taha Ismail, the chief of police in Kirkuk's Kurdish Rahim Awa neighborhood. Before, there were three provinces, Baghdad, Mosul, and Basra, he says. I think it will be three provinces again. History will go back to its original format. Iraq has been a country for 90 years. Throughout this period, he says, these three provinces haven't been able to live together. As if to illustrate his last remark, Jonah and the Whale, Noah and the Ark, and Kurdish forces seized two oil fields in northern Iraq and took over operations from a state-run oil company this week, while Kurdish politicians formally suspended their participation in the government of Prime Minister al-Maliki, escalating a feud between the Shia-led central government and the autonomous Kurdish region. Well, Iraq is fighting off the incursion of a militia. So they got their eye, they all got their eye on the ball over there, as do we. Hello, welcome to the show.
I've just found joy. I'm as happy as a baby boy with another brand new choo-choo toy. When I'm with my sweet Lorraine, pair of eyes that are bluer than the summer skies. When you see them, you'll realize why I love my sweet Lorraine. When it's raining, I won't miss the sun, because it's in my baby's smile. And to think that I'm the lucky one who will lead her down the aisle. Each night I pray that somebody won't steal her heart away. I can't wait until that lucky day when I marry sweet Lorraine. Thank you. When it's raining, I won't miss the sun, 'cause it's in my baby's smile. And to think that I'm the lucky one who will lead her down the aisle. Each night I pray that somebody won't steal her heart away. I can't bide out till that lucky day when I marry sweet Lorraine. Till that lucky day when I marry sweet Lorraine.
From London, England, just off Leicester Square. Fell off Leicester Square, as a matter of fact. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
if you want me to love you, all that you must do is just say so.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in case you were wondering whether people are still, for no good reason at all, beginning their answers to interviewers' questions with the word so, it would appear so.
Let's just begin by talking a little bit about China's drive to invest and build economic relationships in the developing world. I mean, how long has this been happening? What drives it?
Well, so this has happened really in two phases.
And their interest was in both raw materials and markets?
So as China began to emerge as this manufacturing superpower in the 1990s, in the early phases of this, they saw that they had an advantage or an interest in securing sources of raw materials.
Just tell us a little bit about how he got there and what kind of farming business he established.
So Hao Shengli had been a sort of moderately successful businessman back in China.
And how was he able to buy so much arable land?
So Hao had come with a certain amount of savings.
Tell us a bit about kind of what the Chinese bought in Zambia and what kind of economic relationships developed.
So you've got this, the sense of this timing just right.
And what were the relationships like between the Chinese owner of these mines, and I guess some smelting operations too, right, and the African workers who worked there?
So the acquisition of these big mines at the moment in history we were just talking about was done by big Chinese companies.
Do the Chinese intervene in Zambian politics to protect their interests? I mean, you see this in a lot of places.
So they don't really have a lot of leverage with China on these sorts of issues.
So that's not all.
Talk us through the numbers.
So I got a massive amount of information from ICE about the deportations of people over the last 10 years.
Why? Why the drop?
So there are a few reasons for the drop.
Well, how do these numbers play into the whole phenomenon we're witnessing this year of increased border crossings by unaccompanied minors and the debate over what's causing it?
So the Obama administration wants to send this message to parents in Central America not to send their kids over.
So adults, those numbers are up for the same period?
So during that same time that the number of minors being deported has gone down, the total number of people being deported has stayed steady or increased slightly at about 400,000 per year.
Yes, they do indeed. They still say so. Don't ask me why. Because I'll only answer with so. And now,
ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide, to beautify our countryside. We offer you our hand. Let us try.
Well, this is going to be a little visit into the past, ladies and gentlemen, except that it's happening now. Just for background, one of the three canals in New Orleans along which a flood wall collapsed in 2005, generating most of the flooding that occurred in the central part of New Orleans during the 2005 flooding. One of those three canals is the 17th Street Canal. The walls, as I say, along that canal, or at least on the eastern side of that canal, collapsed. the response of the federal government, yours and mine, was to give the Army Corps of Engineers, which had constructed those flood walls, $14 billion and tell them to try again. So they built a perimeter defense, justifying their decision not to touch those flood walls, which they acknowledged were defective. Because if the perimeter is protected, the walls will never be challenged, supposedly, by storm surge ever again from a hurricane. So those walls are as bad as they were on September 28th, 2005. Now the Army Corps of Engineers has embarked on a project of fixing them up a little bit. And here's what is being found according to the Fix the Pumps blog in New Orleans. Photos showing the unearthing of massive amounts of unsuitable debris from the levees this spring and summer bring into stark relief the true nature of flood protection in the greater New Orleans area. By the Corps' own standards, I'm reading the words of the Fix the Pumps blog now, a deeply inadequate system remains in place, a system which under current design and construction guidelines would never get built today. We know this by simply comparing today's pictures to the records of the last 17th Street Canal remediation project just 3 years ago. A new round of the photos, taken in late June, detail more fully the debris that was piled into the 17th Street Canal levees years ago. The same junk was pulled out of the levees a bit north of this year's work site 3 years ago during that first round. Extensive, unsuitable material found inside the levees in 2011. That project consisted mostly of deep soil mixing of grout with existing soil to improve the strength of the soil along both banks of the canal. Right from the start and throughout the entire 2011 project, the Corps' contractors continually found the levees on both sides of the canal were riddled with non-dirt objects. Levees are supposed to be made of, ideally, clayish dirt or dirtish clay. The greatest concentration seems to have been on the west side, that is the side that did not collapse in 2005. Visually, this is from the contractor's quality control report in 2011, quote, virtually inspected the construction of the production pad. Material removed from the existing levee contained significant debris, rocks, concrete, bricks, shells, asphalt. Informed two Corps employees, they came over to look. We asked that they asked them to determine if this would be considered unsuitable to reuse in the construction of the levee. Got a verbal answer a few days later concerning the unsuitable material. We are to excavate to the required depth to build the production platform only, meaning only build the platform necessary to allow new equipment to fix up the top of the levee. That indicated that the Corps believed the rest of the levee was similarly riddled, according to the Fix the Pumps blog. That means there's still likely junk in the 17th Street Canal levee today, just further down than where the 2011 project dug. The Corps didn't bother to tell the public and their government representatives in any meaningful fashion there were rocks, concrete, bricks, shells, and asphalt inside three-quarters of a mile of the 17th Street Canal levee that had been there since it was built decades ago, or that such debris would remain within the levees even after the project was completed. Some of the junk was so huge in 2011 it couldn't even be moved out of the levee. An extreme example was documented by the contractor logs on March 25th. The discovery of a very large concrete object, 20 by 13 feet, unable to be removed. The Corps of Engineers was contacted about it. Their own quality assurance report said the concrete footing is quite thick. It could exceed 2 feet. A room-sized chunk of concrete buried under the levee that didn't get discovered until the levee was dug out. It was so huge, they actually left it in place. The junk is still there today, and the integrity of the outfall canals remains the responsibility of the Corps. And when they were asked about this at a meeting after the blog published this information, and the photographs, which you can go see, fixthepumps.blogspot.com. The response was this: crews working for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have found isolated amounts of concrete and other unsuitable materials in the levees along that canal, but that debris does not present a risk. That's what Corps officials told the board that oversees the flood protection system. The debris was discovered while the Corps was installing new 65-foot-long sheet piling along the canal. By the way, that was what the original contractor said should be done in 1993 or 4. The Corps sued him to say, no, 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 our contract says 17 feet, don't dig any deeper. And that's one reason why the flood wall collapsed and people died. We're confident that this isolated amount of material is not a threat, even if it remains in the levee, says Brad Drunant of the Corps. The Corps has specifications for the types of materials that can be used when building a levee and rules on how much unsuitable material can be allowed in the structure before it presents a risk. The risk is that such materials will not be up to the standards needed to ensure the levee can hold or will allow water to seep through and undermine the levees. Drunant said the amount found in the 17th Street Canal levee is not of concern, although some of it's being removed. The levees, the original levees in that area, date back to before the federal government began designing the flood control system. They sit below the newer, improved levees erected under Corps supervision, Drunant says. So that's reassuring. We put strong stuff on top of the weak stuff on the bottom. Let us try, ladies and gentlemen. The motto of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Let them come build something in your neighborhood, won't you? And now, we're number one. We're not number one. Good Lord, I forgot whether we were or not. The 2014 World Press Freedom Index spotlights the negative impact of conflicts on freedom of information and its protagonists. The ranking of some countries has also been affected by a tendency to interpret national security needs in an overly broad and abusive manner, to the detriment of the right to inform and be informed. This according to Reporters Without Borders, who put out the Fresh Freedom Index every year. The number one is press freedom, Finland. Notice how the Nordic countries end up number one in so many categories. It's like this social democracy thing is a good thing or something. What's that about? Anyway, Finland's number one, closely followed by the Netherlands and Norway. As last year, the last three positions are again held by Turkmenistan, North Korea, and Eritrea, the three countries where freedom of information is non-existent. So where are we, ladies and gentlemen? Countries that pride themselves on being democracies and respecting the rule of law have not set an example, says Reporters Without Borders. Far from it. Freedom of information is too often sacrificed to an overly broad and abusive interpretation of national security needs. This has been the case in the United States, which ranks 46th in the Press Freedom Index, falling 13 places, one of the most significant declines, amid increased efforts to track down whistleblowers and the sources of leaks. The United Kingdom, 33rd, minus 3, distinguished itself in the war on terror by the pressure it put on the Guardian newspaper and by the detention of Glenn Greenwald's partner and assistant. Dozens of journalists have been jailed on the pretext of threats to national security in Turkey, 154th, Morocco, 136th. The authorities readily confuse journalism with terrorism. Israel is up 17 places to 96th. But we're not number one. You know, that's the way it goes when you got a war to fight, especially when it never, ever ends. And now, speaking of never ending, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. We'll be right back. Well, this is an opportunity to use the World Cup events in Brazil as a way to look forward to the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, which the Associated Press duly does, or doesly do. Once the World Cup leaves town, four gleaming stadiums that cost $1.6 billion and hosted massive crowds will echo noisily as their owners struggle to find a use for them or even partially fill them. In the western Brazilian city of... I can't pronounce this Brazilian. Cuiabá, I guess. Chilean and Colombian fans produce sellouts at the World Cup, the next big game at the 260 million stadium in Brazil's third level of soccer. Officials are hoping for 4,000 fans. Similar letdowns await at least three other new stadiums built for the World Cup. None of them has a big-time team, which means no permanent tenants to fill the stands, pay the bills, or service the debt. History suggests the four are ill-advised outlays. Recent World Cups and Olympics have left expensive relics. The $600 million Cape Town Stadium from the 2010 World Cup has hosted just seven football games in 4 years. The symbol of Beijing's 2008 Olympics, the Bird's Nest Stadium, sits as what Rio de Janeiro Mayor Eduardo Paes recently called a mausoleum to honor wasted public money, unquote. Another quote, we don't see a lot of clear evidence from an economic point of view that countries that host these big events have these great legacy effects. Trying to see whom the Associated Press is quoting, saying that. Victor Matheson, a sports economist at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Brazil tourist officials hope the World Cup exposure offers a boost. Brazil only gets 5.5 million foreign tourists annually. Robert Bod, an economist at Lake Forest College near Chicago, spoke to sports ministry officials warning about overspending on stadiums. There's the idea that somehow these stadiums are going to serve as a catalyst for other economic development. He said it just doesn't work that way. There's a lot of dead time. You're talking about a stadium that might be occasionally used. Bade said he visited Barcelona recently, seen as the most successful Olympics in generating urban renewal, and went to the part of the city where the Olympic Stadium is located. Quote, there was virtually no activity up there. And Barcelona is seen as a big success. Unquote. The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day.
Just a day I saw you and your head was in your hands. Said you couldn't face another day. All of life's rejections, all those dreams turned into sand. What's the point? You asked me, so I took your hand and said that when it feels like the rain might fall forever, that when it feels
From London, coming down your street, this is Le Show, and now, news from outside the bubble. The British government's problems with missing files, they already lost some files relating to investigation of alleged pedophile activities among members of parliament. Well, their problems deepened this week when the Foreign Office claimed documents on Britain's role in the CIA's global abduction operation had been destroyed accidentally when they became soaked with water. That damn water! Human rights groups said it smacked of a cover-up, but the department maintains that records of post-9/11 flights in and out of the British territory in the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia, were, quote, incomplete due to water damage, unquote. Yeah, you can't dry those things out because the water... high acid in the water these days. The claim comes amid media reports in the United States that a Senate report due to be published later this year identifies Diego de Garcia as one of the CIA secret prison sites as part of the Extraordinary Rendition Program. Classified CIA documents state the prison was established with the, quote, full cooperation, unquote, of the British government. Hello, Tony Blair. Mideast peace envoy. He's doing well. It also comes at a time when MPs are investigating that pedophile deal. Ministers of successive governments have repeatedly, this is from the Guardian newspaper, ministers of successive governments have given repeatedly misleading or incomplete information about the CIA's use of Diego Garcia. In February 2008, the then Foreign Secretary was forced to apologize to the Parliament and explain that Blair's earlier explicit assurances that Diego Garcia had not been used for rendition flights had not been correct. The admission was only made after human rights groups produced irrefutable evidence that aircraft linked to the rendition program had landed on Diego Garcia. Since then, far more aircraft have been shown to have been involved in the operation. The water damage claim was given in response to a parliamentary question. Records on flight departures and arrivals on Diego Garcia are held by the British Indian Ocean Territory Immigration Authorities. Daily occurrence logs which record the flights landing and taking off cover the period since 2003. Though there are some limited records from 2002, I understand they're incomplete due to water damage, unquote. The Foreign Office would not say whether the damaged files were British or United States records or say where they were located, such as underwater. A Foreign Office spokesperson maintained that because of the damage was only recently discovered, it did not know how or when it occurred. That's a convenient cone of ignorance, wouldn't you say? Water that cone. The activities of users of Twitter and other social media services were recorded and analyzed as part of a major project funded by the U.S. military, similar to Facebook's controversial experiment. The Guardian reports this as well. Research funded directly or indirectly by the U.S. Department of Defense's Military Research Department, known as DARPA, has involved users of some of the Internet's largest destinations, such as Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Kickstarter, for studies of social connections and how messages spread. Several of the DOD-funded studies went further than merely monitoring what users were communicating on their own, instead messaging unwitting participants in order to track and study how they responded. Your Department of Defense in action. The program was regarded as a bid by the U.S. military to become better at both detecting and conducting propaganda campaigns on social media. Papers leaked by Ed Snowden indicate U.S. and British intelligence agencies have been deeply engaged in planning ways to covertly use social media for purposes of propaganda and deception. Documents prepared by NSA and Britain's GCHQ, previously published by The Intercept and NBC News, revealed aspects of some of these programs, including a unit engaged in discrediting the agency's enemies with false information spread online. Well, if it's on the Internet, you can believe it, though, right? And you know by now, perhaps, that a class of insecticides known as neonicotinoids have been fairly authoritatively fingered as the proximate cause of the colony collapse disorder that is being experienced by honeybees in both the United States and Great Britain, I believe. This impinges on our food supply because these bees... you know, do their thing on about 60% of the American food crop. Now, new research has identified those same insecticides, the world's most widely used, by the way, as the key factor in the recent reduction in the numbers of farmland birds in Britain. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the birds and the bees. The finding represents a significant escalation of the known dangers of the insecticides. It follows an assessment in June that warned that pervasive pollution by these nerve agents was now threatening all food production. We don't need food. We can eat each other. This is also from The Guardian. The neonicotinoid insecticides are believed to seriously harm bees and other pollinating insects. A two-year European Union suspension on three of them began at the end of last year. But the suspected knock-on effects on other species had not been demonstrated until peer-reviewed research was published in the journal Nature this week, revealing data from the Netherlands showing that bird populations fell most sharply in those areas where neonicotinoid pollution was the highest. At least 95% of neonicotinoids applied to crops ends up in the wider environment. Thanks for sharing. Killing the insects the birds rely on for food, particularly when raising chicks. We're starving their chicks. Researchers led by Hans de Kroon, an ecologist at Radboud University in the Netherlands, examined other possible reasons for the bird declines. But high pollution by a neonicotinoid known as imidacloprid, so are you, by the way, was by far the largest factor. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now you know that Secretary of State John Kerry has left Kabul after spending about 20 hours banging the heads of the two presidential candidates together. Abdullah Abdullah, the former foreign minister who ran against Hamid Karzai in the last presidential election amid widespread and fairly credible claims of foul play in the awarding of that election to Karzai, and another gentleman named Afghan Ghani, Ghani, G-H-A-N-I. Abdullah led in the first round of the Afghanistan presidential election. They had a second round because he didn't win a majority. And guess what? Ghani won this time. And the election commission, against the wishes of the United States, released those preliminary results this week. And then all hell broke loose in Afghanistan. Abdullah denounced the count of the second round as fraudulent. And there were noises among his supporters, mainly members of the Tajik tribe, that they would form a parallel government if Ghani took office. This was disturbing to the United States, since sounds like Iraq all over again. We don't need two of those, do we? So Secretary of State Kerry flew to Kabul, had 20 hours of talks with the two candidates, got them to agree in the last minute on a UN-sponsored recount of the second round of the election. That's the way it sounds from here. How does it sound from there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where our ombudsman never passed judgment on our journalism.
From the presidential palace in downtown Kabul, home of the never-ending vote count, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid.
We're Slick and Slack, the Outahir brothers. Welcome to Karzai Talk.
Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Afghanistan League of Women Voters. There's a purple finger under every burqa.
Well, my younger brother, maybe the first peaceful transfer of power in our nation's history will have to be put on hold.
If not elected, I will not serve. But yes, the Americans were going to teach us how to be more like America.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out we've just learned how to be more like Florida.
But without the parasailing.
Oh, but we are like Florida in one respect.
And what's that, dear brother?
LeBron James won't be coming back here either.
Of course, the uncertainty over the election results is bad for the economy, too.
Oh, you're
Toyota business is suffering?
Very much so. Mm. The recalls are outnumbering the sales.
Well, as you know, dear brother, I was neutral during the election, so I have only one interest in the outcome.
Yes, making sure it delayed long enough so your pension kicks in.
That's not true. Actually, it is. Mm-hmm. Hello, you're on Kazai Talk.
Hi, this is John. A long-time Secretary of State, second-time caller.
Ah, Mr. Secretary, didn't we just meet a little while ago?
Yes, but I think I may have left my iPhone in your office.
Oh, sir, I'm so sad to report. We won't be able to return it.
Couldn't find it?
No, we found it. Ah. But we're now financing half our budget by reselling the iPhones left in my office.
Blessings upon that comfy couch with the big pillows.
But, Mr. Secretary, much as we appreciate your return to our country, don't you have serious hostilities in the Middle East to mediate just about now?
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'd love to be tackling that. Solving problems like the seemingly intractable conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, or why people like me take this job in the first place.
But?
Well, the Israeli government doesn't want to talk to us right now, and the Palestine government is a terrorist organization, so we can't talk to them.
Well, their loss is our gain. Do you have a question for us?
If you don't, we could feed you one.
No, I'm fine. Basically, Hamid, based on what you know, do you think the second round of presidential balloting in your country was on the level?
Based on what he knows, his re-election wasn't on the level.
Hey, both sides did some rigging. Mm. The better rigger won.
That's true.
See, you are learning from us.
Yes, we are.
But, Hamid, I am wondering if you can get your Tajik brothers to accept the apparent victory of Mr. Ghani, even though he is, as I understand it, a member of the Pashtun tribe.
John, we are Pashtuns, too. The Tajiks care as much about what we think as the Mexican mafia cares about what the Sicilian mafia thinks.
Except we're not as good at organized crime.
Well, that's not what I hear.
Oh, we're as good at the crime, just not at the organized.
Well, I could spend all day talking with you guys.
No, you couldn't. This Afghani Life is up next with a special program about a rug seller who memorized the entire Encyclopedia Afghanica.
Sounds great, but I do have to get back to trying to convince your two would-be successors to agree to a UN-supervised vote count.
Oh, they'll agree to that, John. Oh. At the same time, they agree to a UN-sponsored pony drop.
Thanks for the call. Gee, he's got good hair.
What? You can hear it on the line?
No. I was just looking at the selfies on his iPhone. Hello, you are on Karzai Talk.
Hello, this is Abdullah. Two-time presidential candidate, first-time caller.
Abdullah. The candidate's so nice, they screwed him twice.
My brother's just bitter because he's got a lot full of rusting tundras. So, my former foreign minister, do you have a question for us, since that is what lights our improvisational fire?
Well, since I won the first round of this election, and since I'm just about to agree to Mr. Kerry's UN-sponsored recount of the second round, I was just wondering if you have any, shall we say, juice in selecting the recounters.
My friend, my dear brother has more juice than a Venice Beach health food bar.
Actually, I'm sure the recounters are going to be selected from a roster of independent people who have great experience in this field.
And who supplies the roster?
Well, it will be compiled from
the people who attended our last family reunion.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Attending our family reunion is the field in which they'll have had the experience.
Yes, of course. So, are you having a pledge drive at this time, or how else can I...
Well, that's the great thing about our kind of public radio, Abdullah. It's always pledge drive time. I'll take your call off the air as soon as we sign off.
Well, I want a few recounters and the tote bag.
Well, we are out of time for this edition of Karzai Talk. We had help today from the Afghanistan Poppy Growers Foundation. We're addicted to jobs. Legal help for Karzai Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. Join us again later during the recount for another edition of Karzai Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
In many years, in recent years, many colleges have considered their institutions' ties to slavery and how to appropriately acknowledge that history. Such a discussion has come to a head at Washington and Lee University, whose president this week acknowledged and apologized for a history in which the university itself owned slaves, and announced that Confederate flags that have been on display next to a statue of Robert E. Lee, the namesake of the university, will be removed. The president's statement followed several months of sometimes divisive debate after a group of Brock law students demanded a series of changes in the university, some of which are addressed in the president's letter of apology. Dateline Seattle, Seattle City Attorney Peter Holmes has now apologized for buying marijuana during working hours and stashing the baggies in his office at City Hall. You know that it just became legal to have marijuana in Washington State. Hey, wait, don't all go there. In a statement released Friday afternoon, Holmes acknowledged that his actions were in violation of a city policy that prohibits employees from possessing marijuana while on city premises or while conducting official business off the premises. Holmes purchased two-gram baggies of pot in front of news cameras on the opening day of recreational marijuana sales. His statement says the city of Seattle is a drug-free workplace under federal law, and our personnel rules reflect these sound workplace policies. City employees cannot possess controlled substances while on city business. The workplace rule has not changed. I was elected to drive reform, drug policy reform. But that workplace rule has not changed. When I brought the unopened marijuana to city offices, trying to keep up with a busy schedule, I nonetheless violated the city's rules. At the end of the business day, I took the marijuana home and left it there, still unopened. I've discussed the violation with the city personnel department director, and I volunteered to donate $3,000 to the Downtown Emergency Service Center. I apologize to my employees, all city employees, and to the public. Quote, the city of Seattle receives federal funding. That's why it's bound by the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act, passed at the end of the Reagan administration. Dayline Kuala Lumpur, a Malaysian politician who took to Twitter after Germany beat Brazil in the World Cup semifinal and praised Hitler, has apologized. Bung Mukhtar Radin, a member of Malaysian parliament, tweeted his apology. When Germany whacked Brazil, I unintentionally said something that hurt the feeling of the people in Germany. My sincerest apology. Long live Bung. That's his name. He sparked international outrage over his original tweet, which read, addressed to Germany, well done, bravo, long live Hitler. Unquote. Dateline Johannesburg, South Africa. After days of heavy criticism over an advertisement that was meant to promote the plight of South Africa's hungry children, the aid organization Feed a Child has apologized for any offense it caused. The recent advertisement showed a seemingly rich white woman feeding a black child. The headline read, "The average domestic dog eats better than millions of children." The charity's founder said the group did not consult widely on the advertisement, saying the tagline was anecdotal and not based on researched facts. We shot this ad to get reaction from the public that there are hungry children out there, she said. The advertisement was fully sponsored by Ogilvy & Mather, the ad agency that came up with the concept. They uploaded an apology on its website, the ad agency's website, saying the advertisement was aimed at drawing attention to the extremely important issue of malnutrition in South Africa. We're aware of the negative reaction to the commercial since receiving an official complaint. Feed a Child and Ogilvy & Mather have withdrawn the commercial. It was not our intention to offend in any way, and therefore we unreservedly apologize for any offense caused. My God, ladies and gentlemen. An ad agency apologizes for its ad. Rip out the front page. And then carefully paste it back in. Giving a statement to USA Today, actor and director George Clooney rejected a rare apology offered by the British tabloid The Daily Mail this week, accusing the tabloid of a premeditated lie and being engaged in a cover-up. The confrontation began when Clooney demanded a retraction after Mail Online said the Lebanese mother of his fiancée objected to the pair's impending marriage on religious grounds. At the time, Clooney said the article was entirely made up. The Mail, which had reprinted a truncated version of the online piece in print, almost immediately apologized, but that response only served to infuriate Clooney further. And the New York Yankees will be without Masahiro Tanaka for at least 6 weeks after he was diagnosed with a partially torn ligament in his elbow this week, for which he apologized. Right now, I feel that the most important thing for me is to keep my head up, remain focused on the task at hand, and devote all my energy into healing the injury. I want to apologize to the Yankees organization, my teammates, and my fans for not being able to help during this time. So you see, some cultural stereotypes really are true. He apologized for being injured. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. bidding farewell to Charlie Hayden. This has been Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. And available as a free podcast from wwno.org, SoundCloud, Sideshow Network, and iTunes. Free! Maybe just like getting off our streets. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, Jenny Lawson at WWNO in New Orleans, and Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. Join the more than 100,000 followers of mine on Twitter, if you like. I'm at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.